The Idiot Players are very pleased to bring you what we intend to be a series of conversations with important thinkers and beers and doers. The Idiot Players podcast aims to explore art, creativity, and expression. If there is an elephant standing in the dark, as the Sufi story goes, we want to do more than grope and theorize. We invite conversations with people who aim from the heart to make practical the far-reaching. Welcome to the Idiot Players Podcast. This is Gregory, your host at the podcast Caravanserai. In episode 14, we welcome Winnie Givett. Winnie is a watercolor artist based in the high desert of Sisters, Oregon. She worked for many years at the Two Rivers Farm near Aurora, Oregon, with Mrs. Stavely. And during her time there, she was also deeply influenced by artist Nani Hirgrogian and writer David Curdian. She tells us that upon leaving the community with her husband to move to the interior some years ago, she realized that she had been given all of the tools needed to continue the work of self-discovery on her own. She has used these tools to become a teacher of watercolor painting and, moreover, a teacher of seeking that sacred space within through which art can enter the world of things. In our conversation, Winnie shares her insight and her passion for painting. Her work is highly regarded and indeed is extraordinary. Winnie conveys a wonderful sense of being in her life with others and feels deeply the need to connect and to make meaning through beauty. I apologize to listeners for the hiatus that appears to have opened between this post and the previous one with Trevor Stewart. Functional life picked up apace, and I have also been taking some time to write. Listening to the conversation with Winnie and preparing the podcast was a wonderful way to reconnect to the mission here at idiotplayers.org. What I hear in the conversation is the urgency of the message that Winnie brings to people. Be yourself. And, moreover, learn to discover yourself at a level different than who you assume yourself to be. Question. And bring a certain equanimity to the process, whatever it may bring. Learn to be. This conversation was recorded on Tuesday, August 28th, 2012, and runs approximately 90 minutes. It is being published on Saturday, November 10th, 2012. Winnie Givett, welcome to the Idiot Players Podcast. This is going to go out as podcast number 14, and thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show.
You're very welcome, and thank you for inviting me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am, and the listeners are looking forward to a conversation. You're a watercolor artist. You've been practicing your art for a number of years. You've achieved notoriety and success. And you've also are coming from a background of, you know, the Gurdjieff work. And our listeners are primarily interested in seeing how these things relate together, you know, in someone's life. How do they make that, you know, work for them as a creative touchstone? So Thank you for being on board. One thing, the first question I think I'm going to throw out to you is, why watercolor? Why that choice of medium for you? What attracts you to watercolor?
Oh, I love watercolor. I love how it flows. I love how it does its own thing. And some people are frustrated because they can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, and you can't paint over it like you can with oils or acrylics, but you also get this magical luminosity. And just watching what the paint does on the paper and how it interacts with other paints that are put beside it or with it is just fascinating. Mm-hmm. And it can be controlled. I've learned how to do that. So when I want a high degree of control, I can get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the translucency of it.
Right.
The transparency. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned watercolor is a paint that is pretty unforgiving as far as, you know, once it's on the paper, you can't sort of cover it up or get it off. So you're...
Well, you
go
can.
Ahead. Yeah. Actually.
Yeah, you can get it off, but it's not as easy as it is with oils. You can't just take a brush of paint. Well, you can go on over it with a darker color and change it that way. And there's various techniques for lifting. But again, they're techniques that people need to learn. There's some basic things you have to learn how to handle the water in watercolor. And that can be very frustrating at first, not knowing how much water to have on your brush or mix with a pigment. And so there's some techniques involved that can be learned, and then it's fantastic.
Right. Well,
anywhere you're learned is fantastic if you're willing to play. Trying to control it, it doesn't work at the beginning. But if you allow the watercolor to play on the paper, it's just really fun from the beginning.
That's wonderful. One of the pieces on your website's called, I believe it's called Red Shoes.
Yes.
And that stood out to me first of all, my first impression was for the photographic clarity of it. You know, like the shoes, my eyes went immediately to the shoes, and it was just captivated by the texture that you had worked into the leather on the shoes. It was three-dimensional, really. That, like a technique like that, do you remember painting that particular piece?
Yes, I remember painting that particular piece, and it was so much fun, and it was especially fun to get that feeling of leather and the three-dimensionality of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just love doing that.
And the lines were so sharp. And then the rest, like the background, you could, it had a watercolor feel to the background, but the shoes themselves had such a definiteness and clarity. And the contrast between that and the background was very striking.
Yeah, it's just really fun to play one element against another.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about play, allowing that paint to do what it needs to do on the paper, is that part of what you're teaching when you're leading? Like, do people have to kind of... What's the process of somebody kind of letting go and allowing that to happen? Is there some kind of inner process going on there?
Yes, there does need to be an inner process. Excuse me, Irv was just here. So let's see. And one of the things I do when I teach classes is I begin the class with some kind of reading. From something totally different. You know, it could be Mary Oliver. It could be something from Deepak Chopra. It could be, I've got a quote from Nickel that I read sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask a question and ask people to answer it. And from their own perspective about, why is watercolor, why do you want to paint in watercolor?
Yeah.
Or what do you want to learn? And what I'm doing with both of those is trying to help people get release the fear, because everybody comes with fear. And we all have fear when we're starting a painting. You know, there's the fear of the white paper, the fear that I won't do a good enough job. And, of course, there's the identification with everything we do.
Mm-hmm.
So letting go of that is I want to help people relax so that they can just enjoy the process.
Mm-hmm. Can you take us through a little bit your own process of learning to paint in this way? When did that start, and how were you attracted to it? And one quote on your website that stood out to me is that you didn't realize you were an artist until you were a mature woman, later in life.
I think, I always had done something with art, with crafts, really. My mom did lots of things. My dad was really handy, and I could always figure out how to do things. I built a fairly funky house up in the mountains of New Mexico, just, making it up as we went, really, reading, looking at other people's stuff, but we didn't know what we were doing. And we've done a lot of, that's how I've approached a lot of things. I've taught myself, to cook, to garden, to make stage sets, to do all kinds of things, costuming for plays. And when I got to watercolor, backing up a little bit, at Two Rivers Farm, where I was for an extended period of time, Nani Hogrovian was there.
Okay. Nania?
No, Nani.
Okay, Nani, yep.
And she's David Curdian's wife.
Okay.
You may have heard of.
I've heard, but I couldn't say more than that. Yeah. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that background?
Nani is an illustrator. She does beautiful drawings, and she did quite a few for Mrs. Staveley's books at the farm, and also for her husband David's books and other children's stories. And several of us, she taught us drawing, and I would go to her house a couple afternoons a week, or a couple hours once a week, and have a drawing class. And that was my beginning. And I did that for, quite a few years, for a couple of years. And then she gathered a group of us together to do art, thinking we would do a soapstone sculpture and we were all going to practice on something. And I ended up getting together with a group of people twice a week. And we did that. It changed format, but I was always there. I was the one person who was always there, and other people kind of came and went. Right. And it didn't matter whether we were drawing or sculpting or painting or what. And I realized at some point that I could teach myself to do a lot of other things, but I needed to take classes to learn about watercolor. Mm. And so I did.
Right.
I started taking community ed classes. That was my beginning in Aurora, or in Canby, which is very close to Aurora. And shortly after that.
And this is all happening in Oregon.
Yes, this is all happening in Oregon.
Yeah.
And then in 92, we moved here to Central Oregon, to Sisters, Oregon, which is high desert, which is, what else can I say about it? It's hard to describe. But it was a complete cut with everything that had gone before. Hmm. My husband started a new practice, but he left his old one. I helped him with setting that up, doing the office things. But the children who were in, 8th and 11th grade didn't have a lot of after-school activities. I didn't have any commitments for volunteering or working anywhere except for helping my husband and being home. And this left me time to paint, and I did. And I started taking workshops and all the watercolor classes I could, and I painted every day for hours.
Hmm.
And that was when I really took off. So that was 20 years ago.
Wow.
And I began by painting a lot and getting whatever instruction I could find.
Mm-hmm. And were you surprised at all with your own level of commitment to it? Was that something revealing or fresh for you that you would want to spend so much time at that?
The previous year before we moved, I felt myself coming down with a flu. And at that point, I was doing a little wash, watercolor wash on a pen and ink drawing. And I was going to finish that before I went to bed. I knew once I lay down, I would be out for days. But I had to finish that little painting, and I took it and I put it up on my dresser where I could see it in bed. And then I was, you know, kind of moving in and out like you do when you have a high fever. And at one point I felt something saying, you have to paint in watercolor. And that was when that was my beginning. And so that's when I started signing up for classes. That's when I signed up for workshops. When we were moving, I said to my husband, can I have a studio in the new place? We were talking about building at that point, and he said yes. And we ended up moving into a place that actually had a studio in the barn. Little. And it was like, yeah, the universe is conspiring for me to be a watercolorist.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Now, looking at your paintings, the quality of light. Now, you mentioned, you know, some of that is in the medium itself, you know, watercolor, you know, lends itself to that. But certainly, you know, there's a lot of it that's coming through the brush and the artist. Tell us about that. Is that one of the goals you're striving for when you paint?
If I can get light into a painting, I love it. And with portraits especially, I want to get really good light on the subject. And I rarely pick a reference now that doesn't have wonderful lights and darks in the face. Other subject is harder. You know, when I go out and paint on location, which I often do, doing landscapes, you know, you look for the light. Sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. When I'm setting up a still life in the studio, I don't have great lighting. And sometimes I'll set them up near a window and only paint for the hour or two a day when the light is coming in on the subject. So I get it. But times, like when I'm setting up a still life for the class that I'm, teaching, which I like to do because it's really useful for people to learn to paint from life. It's much more accurate than, they can become more accurate and see more than painting from a photograph. So going back to setting up a still life, I am often hard put to get good lighting on it. I can get medium, you know, I can get so-so lighting on it. But that's one of the ways my studio's not great.
Okay. for me, because I'm not a painter as yet anyway, at least I haven't discovered that passion in myself, it's just mesmerizing for me. How does that light get in there? Because I always think that then I have to... I can't get over the idea that there's a point source, and that somehow, how does the artist with the brush visualize all of that? And don't they have to remove stuff in order to get the light in there? Or like, how do you know how much to add and all of that? What's that skill about?
Well, light, you see light because of the darkness around it.
Okay.
And if you don't, you start out in watercolor with a white sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And that's your lightest light.
Yeah.
And you start adding different darker, slightly darker values and darker values until you have something dark against the light and makes it look
dark. Okay.
You think about Rembrandt and how his paintings are, a lot of them, pretty dark, and then he has points of light in them, which seem extraordinary, partially because he has this beautiful, rich dark that the light comes out of. So it's, you can't be the sun.
Right.
Well, maybe we can be.
Yes, in some interstate, sure.
But you can't be the sun shining, you don't, you put the dark around the light and it makes it come forward, makes it shine. You put in the shadows and it lets you know that there's light.
Okay. That's helpful.
Well, one more thing that I can say here is that learning to paint is a great deal of it is about learning to see. And when we ordinarily see things, most people, I mean, we see a face and we look at, you know, we say, oh, it's a person's face. We look at the eyes, the nose, the eyebrows, the mouth. But when I go to paint a portrait, and when I go to draw it, I'm not really looking and thinking eye so much as looking at the different shapes that are there. And I draw the shapes, which is, anyhow, learning to see in a different way is very, very important. And it's almost half the, you know, learning to handle the medium is one aspect and learning to see is another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very helpful, because I think I can certainly appreciate what you're saying in terms of our seeing is automatic. You know, I look at you now on this fuzzy sort of Skype image, and but you know, to really kind of see you, I've got to, you know, I can't just look at the fuzzy Skype image. I'm hearing your voice. I'm watching the expression on your face. I'm seeing in a different way because this medium is making me more attentive, right, to what's going on. And presumably then in front of the canvas, you're more attentive. You've trained yourself to see in a different way, as you say.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you cover a variety of different you've got still lifes, you paint people, you paint landscapes. Some of your work is a little more abstract. Most of it seems fairly representative, like there's actually something there that you're painting.
Right.
How do you choose your subjects, and in what relationship do you form that way?
What I'm really interested in is if I see something that's beautiful and it touches me, and it can be the expression on someone's face, portraits that are intriguing because how do you show the inner beauty of a person?
Mm-hmm.
I love flowers. They're incredibly beautiful. I just spent, some time down in the Redwoods painting. And of course, they're extraordinarily beautiful, but the energy of the Redwoods is what I really wanted to capture.
Hmm.
There is a Sufi saying that beauty is the point of contact with love.
Hmm.
And that's very relevant for me. But yeah, I mean, you know, the beauty of a slice of cantaloupe, you know, it's like you can my beauty in so many places.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't have to look for it. It's there all around me. So yeah, that's what I want to paint more than anything else is beauty. And, while I can appreciate a lot of abstract works that I find beautiful, I don't get my inspiration to create things like that out of my head. I get them from seeing something that I find beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and then finding a way to portray it so that that beauty shines through on the paper.
And is that, because now that you've put that in such wonderful context, you know, living things, do they tend to be more attractive to you in that way because of the way that they're transforming energies and that whole process of, as you say, energetic kind of, you know, presence that you find in the Redwoods, for example.
Right. I don't rule out beautiful objects. I'll include those as well.
Good.
Especially things that have meaning for me. But shape and line and form all create beauty. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, everything's alive anyhow.
Yep. Good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can't rule out anything per se, but I don't find, oh, anyhow, continue. What was your question?
No, that's good. I mean, it was sort of to get underneath that sense of beauty. Was it living things, or was it, you know, the relationship that you have when you encounter something, you know, and there is beauty in that. Now you've got to paint it. You know, you feel the urge to paint it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Something comes to me and I just want to put it on paper, and have the great pleasure of painting it, because it is a wonderful experience. And of course it can be frustrating, and you know, I can criticize myself and say, oh, I'm not doing very well or whatever else, but it can be just wonderful, watching the evolution of a painting, watching how, adding a little bit of a stroke of color here and then a stroke of color there, and watching the paint move around, as I develop, say, a petal on a flower, mm-hmm. or a eye, watching a person come alive, as I add the different elements, add the paint, is just great joy.
That, what I'm hearing in what you're describing, twigs for me, because there's that sort of, that shift of state when the brush is on the paper, and then you're back from it, looking at it now as a viewer, seeing mm-hmm. where it's at and where it needs to go. That happens yep. so quickly, that shifting. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, because it's a different state maybe, or what's happening there for you?
I don't know whether that's a different state. I'm the artist in both cases.
Yep.
Putting the paint on the paper and then stepping back to see what it looks like and what else is needed and what's happened with that stroke, and then going forward and seeing what the next stroke is and putting it in place. So as I suppose I am looking at it when I'm in the back as a viewer might, and imagining, you know, but I'm just trying to see the painting as it looks and looking to see what it needs to come for its next step.
Hmm. You mentioned a while back a move from what sounded like maybe more coastal area up to a desert type environment. There must have been a change in light. I mean, I moved out of the Toronto, the big city that's kind of in close proximity to me, about 5 years ago, to the Niagara region. And I really noticed a change in the quality of light. When I try to explain it to people, I don't know whether I do such a good job, but it's mostly to me a shift from kind of silver light in Toronto to a very golden kind of light in the Niagara region. And I don't know what accounts for that, but boy, it's palpable when I experience it, you know.
Yes, that's very true. The light, we lived in the Willamette Valley, which is why Oregon's known as green.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these, you know, great fir trees and wonderful fields, along with, that's where Portland and Salem and all the big cities are for the most part. And then moving over to the high and dry, we're up at 3,000 feet and only get 12 to 14 inches of water a year.
Wow.
So it's quite different. But there are the mountains right out my back door, the Cascade Range. And it is, the light is much more pure, and it's sunnier here. And it doesn't have the green cast that there is in the valley. It is much more golden, like you were saying. Hmm. And whiter. It's also whiter.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. Now you do now lead workshops there in Sisters, Oregon, where you are, as well. You travel to different places in the world, Italy in particular. How did that all come about? You know, getting your name out there and developing that network, and you know, being able to teach and lead people in study.
It came about a friend of mine who's also an artist, Jude Siegel, and who also was at Rivers Farm, and I. She lives in Portland, and she and I were both teaching independently of each other. And we also taught some, we started teaching some workshops together in the summer, 3-day workshops. But we also took a trip to Italy together in 2007. And we kind of said to each other at that point, wouldn't it be fabulous if we could bring students here? And by 2009, it had come together for us to do that.
Wow.
And so we both brought students together, and we went, she had connected with a woman in Sicily to help us with lodging and food and transportation. And she was kind of our coordinator. And so she set things up on the physical plane for us, and then we did the teaching and took care of the class and the students.
Wow.
And it was fabulous.
Have you been doing that now?
Well, we did it together in 2009. I took a group by myself in 2010, and I'm taking another group in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
Sicily. Yeah. So I love doing it. I love teaching, and I love traveling, especially in Italy. And we do journals that we can just put this watercolor journal that we make before we go. We put that and a little travel palette and brushes and pens and pencils and all in a bag that you just carry on your shoulder. And so it's very portable, and we go and we find, well, I go and I find a wonderful place where we can paint and then give a class at, you know, that take the class and give a lesson, to the students at that point. And then there's a lot of freedom for them to develop the page, but I also give them direction as to how they might do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I teach both technique, but also just give suggestions and, you know, help them find how they can paint to express what they want to express in the context of wherever we are. And I take levels, you know. I have some beginners, and I have some quite advanced students. And I think in this trip to Sicily, I don't think I'll have any beginners, but we'll see. I still have a couple of people that haven't committed. Go ahead.
Okay, no. And have you been at that teaching aspect long enough really to watch students develop from more or less beginners to quite a high level of proficiency?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have some students that studied with me for quite a while who are now, you know, professional artists. One has a book out. They're very good artists,
mm-hmm.
and they're people that started with me. One of them, you know, had expressed her desire to paint, but then she stepped back but the way she'd expressed it was so strong that I really pushed for her to paint, and she did. And actually, several of the people I'm thinking of are in the work.
Mm-hmm.
In a group in Bend called the Metanoia Society.
Okay.
That Carrie Kimmler heads up.
Say the name again.
Carrie Kimmler.
Okay, good. Yeah. Now, since you've brought up the work, I wanted to cycle back. You said that you had spent a number of years at the Two Rivers Farm, and I'm interested, and I think our listeners are too, in how the ideas and practices of the work have, how you've brought them into painting, into your teaching, into your life. I know that's kind of a big open-ended question, but you could come at it any way you like.
Well, the work is extremely important to me, in both my life and in my art. And at the point when we were about to move from Two Rivers Farm and the Aurora area to Central Oregon, I really asked myself, is this, you know, is this the right thing for me? What's most important? And I realized it was the work. And that was, at that point, I wasn't painting very much. That was before I'd really delved into it. But I work every day a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've been in the work now for, 36 years or something?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty long time. And, you know, I keep wanting to get deeper in myself and see the connections, between all of us and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that is something very essential, is how everything and everyone is connected. We're all individuals, but we all have this commonality, and we tend to think of ourselves as separate. And I think we make ourselves separate from when we're young children by, we build up these protective walls,
mm-hmm.
and these, you know, identities to present to the world. And then we feel that's who we are. And it takes a lot of work to dig down underneath all of that to find out who indeed I might actually be. And I still have this personality. I still have these skills that I've developed. But underneath that, there is something very real that is not part of all the identification, all the negativities, little eyes that yammer on and on,
mm-hmm.
in our heads. So digging deeper and deeper and connecting with that part of myself and every time I do that, it's wonderful. Well, it depends on how much I can connect. You know, sometimes
yeah.
I'm just stuck, you know, and can't get anywhere. But other times I can very much connect with a real definite part of myself. And when that happens, I can begin to feel the connection with so much more.
Mm.
Instead of just feeling, you know, that I am this person inside these walls that I've built.
Hmm.
It's wonderful. So how does all that apply to my art?
Can I, before you go there?
Yes, please do.
Because you've, in your very wonderful and formal answer to the question, personal answer to the question, of course, you've touched on, you know, some buzzwords in terms of many eyes, in terms of personality, and although you didn't mention it, essence, you know, these are the kinds of things that somebody, you know, reading the ideas of the work comes across in various places. But obviously you found a way to make them real. For yourself and presumably for those around you, for your students, and in the creation of your art. What's important for people to understand about making some of those important ideas real for themselves?
Wow. Well, Mrs. Stavely used to say, little steps for little feet.
Okay.
So it is one small step at a time. And with my students in my classes, I don't use much of that terminology.
Yep.
Because I mentioned that I had quite a few students that were in the work, but I also always have a lot of students that aren't. And usually, you know, that's more the case, is I have people that are not in the work. I For many years, I taught a workshop in the summer called Sacred Images Workshop. And that was about not painting a picture of Christ or Buddha, but of painting from a sacred space within ourselves. And I've had people in that class that have been in the work, but I've also had people in that class that are not. And everybody has this desire to come from a sacred place within themselves. Everybody in that class. Mm-hmm. I actually think that most people have that desire, but it might be buried pretty deep. But that's a whole other issue.
Sure.
And so how can I, you know, in that workshop, I was given the opportunity to have people who specifically wanted that, and I would work, we would begin with a sitting in the morning. And so people could get centered. And oftentimes my husband Irv would lead that. He's led a lot of sittings in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And was trained at that at Two Rivers Farm again. So, but have people connect deeply within. And then it's a question of, you know, coming back to our breath. And this I do in all my classes because we all hold our breaths, you know, as we're painting and something's difficult or we're struggling with it, you hold your breath.
Yeah.
Breathing. And there's things like breathing, which are very possible for everybody to do. And that's something I can just remind people of in my ordinary class. Whether they're in the work or not, people can relate to that and laugh about, oh, yeah, I'm holding my breath again.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I work also with young people and as a teacher. And I lead a little club called the Consciousness Club at the school mm-hmm. I teach at. And invite, you know, students in once a week. Sometimes we chat and, you know, but sometimes we watch a bit of a video and, but mostly the idea is to learn a basic kind of relaxation technique, you know, which
right.
is primarily, let's just become aware of the fact that we're breathing right now, that the body is breathing. And let's try to watch that and even maybe even enjoy it if that's possible for us, you know, just allowing the air to flow in and to flow out. And there's, you know, it's so much wisdom in that practice. You know, I have students who will say, I didn't realize I was breathing, you know,
like <Right.
Exactly. laughs> very, very honest, very honest things, you know, like I've never sat still before for like 3 minutes. I wasn't aware that I sat right. still before and how just the experience of the presence of one's body begins to open up that dimension that you're talking about, I believe right. you're talking about, in terms of connecting, right? You know,
yes.
Because that was one of the, you know, that was the theme that you started off with a couple of minutes ago, that the work is allowing you to connect, you know, to find ways of expanding connection.
Right.
In life and in the world with other people inside yourself through your art. So yeah, I think that those simple things, I mean, a lot of that terminology, as far as I can tell, has kind of entered into popular language or, you know, tuning in and, vibe and all of this, you know, kind of language that we're exposed to, but then to be invited to actually engage in it without it becoming a bit of a joke or something like that. Because often that's what I find, that getting comfortable with yourself is sometimes made fun of in the media and so forth. Like, ooh, you're going to go sit on a mountain somewhere and do all of that kind of thing. And it's not far. It's not very far to be able to get in touch with yourself. But that's great. The work that you're doing sounds wonderful in terms of painting and bringing people to that. You were going to make the connection to your art, in terms of the work and your art.
Well, I talked a little bit about the sacred image workshops, about people, the state they're in is what makes sacred art. If you can be in a sacred state, aware of yourself. And that is, in the work we say, sensing ourselves and remembering ourselves. And that's a tall order, especially when you're in, it's one thing to do it when you're on your stool or your cushion, but it's another thing to do it in the midst of activity.
Yeah.
And I had a very amazing experience with one large painting that I created and presented to the Chilean Congress. And this was in 2000. So it was a while ago, but my intention for that painting was that it would, how can I say this? Sorry, I'm taking so long. It's just a long moment.
No problem.
My intention for that painting, it was a result of my daughters calling me more than a year before that and telling me about this river that was going to be drowned to create electricity, which was probably going to all be sold to Argentina, and not used in Chile, and that all these indigenous people would be displaced from homes their families had lived in for 2,000 years or more, and that after that I went down to Chile where she was at the time and spent a couple weeks with her and went up into the Andes and met these women that were trying to defend their home and spent time down on the river, and I painted it, and I painted them, and I painted the mountains, and I just had this strong impression that I wanted to do something through my art. And I thought of Thomas Moran, whose paintings caused Congress to start the national park, the first national park, I think it was Yellowstone.
Right.
But anyhow, because of his paintings. And I thought, hey, art's powerful, and maybe I can do something. And I went down and did all these paintings and drawings and met these people. And I came home, and I had no idea what I was going to do, and so I just left it. And 9 months later, which would have been December, I had the feeling that I should start to do something. And I ended up taking 50 of the hundreds and hundreds of photos I'd taken. They were roll film, and so I didn't have thousands. But
yeah.
So I think I used about 50 different photographs and created a painting that is about, what, a little under 4 feet to 5.5 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was painting that and working on it, drawing it, the whole process, I found that I could observe myself saying, oh, this is great. Oh, aren't I wonderful for doing this? And then in the next breath almost, it would be, oh, I'm not good enough. This is terrible. I can't do this. So I swing back and forth on that, but it's all that was personality and ego. And I wanted to come from a more real place in myself. And also a wish that this painting would would carry with it my wish for the decisions that the Congress would be making would be to, their decisions would be to honor the people and the land rather than for greed and money.
Right.
So that was what I was wishing for, and that's what I wanted to go into the painting. And if I'm all worried about what people will think about me and how good and how bad I am, that has nothing to do with that. So I worked on this painting, and it wasn't until, well, the two nights before I had to stop, I stayed up all night for two nights in a row because I had a deadline, I had a plane to catch to take it down. And there was one moment at that point when I was pretty tired, worked pretty hard, where I felt like I was painting as I was remembering myself. A moment of self-remembering in all the months of work that I had done. And I got one moment.
Wow.
But that was okay. All work, my repeated efforts, they all count. And their energy went into the painting.
Right.
As well as that one moment of self-remembering. Hmm. And people came here to see it that day when I had to stop. A lot of people wanted to see it, and they came, and they were so touched by it. And then I put it in a roll and flew to Chile, and that's a whole other story. And the Chileans actually cried when they saw it.
Wow.
And they're more emotional people than we are. Hmm. And they allow themselves to express. But that was so wonderful for me to have them be touched so deeply by this painting that I, you know. So I think there is an energy.
Sure, yeah.
It goes into every work of art, every painting, every drawing, everything we do, in fact. But most of the time, because we're so scattered and so worried about what people will think or whatever form our particular way of, you know, our characteristics are. But if we're focused, then that energy goes into the painting. Mm-hmm. And all put energy into the painting. Even, you know, it doesn't matter that I can't do it. If I make the effort to do it, that energy goes into the painting or whatever it is I'm doing.
Sure.
Yeah, it can, you know, in a relationship with a person, I can see that I'm being critical of them. And as soon as I see it and come back into myself and let that go, even if I can't let it go completely, those efforts count. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, well said. I've been thinking, and it came up again while you were talking, John Bennett's beautiful antithesis about knowledge and understanding, where he says knowledge is something that can be communicated but not transferred, whereas mm-hmm. understanding can be transferred but not communicated.
Yes. I guess. I don't...
I mean, what I heard and what you were saying is that understanding, that transference, is that energetic something that's going in. You're not going to be able to write it in words. You're not going to be able necessarily... You did a very beautiful job talking about it, and something came through in what you were saying, but it wasn't necessarily in the words... It was mm-hmm. in the fact that you were making contact with what you were talking about.
Yes.
And that transferred. That's what I believe he was speaking of, or at least that's what I get. And, you know, in terms of all of these, you know, I was packing the car the other day myself. I'm a musician, and my partner, Inji, we play together. She's a wonderful pianist, and I sing. And I was packing all the gear up in the car, and while I was doing it, I heard, you know, this self-righteous voice inside me going, you know, you're really good at this packing up business. You know, you always get everything all in the right spot. And so just after, you know, I had congratulated myself, I walked back into the house, and we were getting into the car after, and Angie said, do we have the microphone and the music? I had forgot that, right? You know, in the house. So two very key elements to the whole performance, the music that we were going to play and the microphone that I was going to sing into. So then the experience was, you know, that nice sort of the gentle steam of humiliation, you know, that the personality has to suffer. And I laughed, you know, and I told her this story, right, about myself patting myself on the back, right?
It happens every time. Movements is a great place for observing that.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Yes.
And as soon as you say that, you fall on your face.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But I liked the way that you described that one moment of self-remembering, which in clock time is brief. But because so much repetition and practice has gone into that one moment, that it has such potency in it, you know, we use the word practice, and it, you know, literally it is, you're practicing, right? Mm-hmm. Just as a musician or as a painter, you're practicing. And then there you go. There's that one moment. Where does it come from? How does it come? You know, we could talk about all of that, but nevertheless, to be gifted with that, there's a lot of food there that sustains your work from that point on, you know.
Yes. And the practice is crucial. In art, in painting, so many people, it's kind of this culture, it seems, believes that you either are an artist, a painter, or you're not.
Yeah.
You're born with talent and you can do it. And I realized pretty early on that what was most important was people have the desire.
Yeah, yeah.
If they have desire to paint, then they will spend the time necessary to paint. Yeah. And you just have to do a lot of it. It's practice. And we expect to get masterpieces right off the bat. And if we can't, then we're not artists. You know, yeah. We're not painters. But that's not true. It takes, you know, as somebody said, 500 paintings before you can start to get consistent results. And so it's the number. It's how many miles you have on your paintbrush.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was listening to an interview the other day with a writer, and I really enjoyed what he was saying. He got to a point in the conversation where he was talking about, okay, there's 95% is the craft, right? Making sure I show up, making sure I got my pencil sharpened, making sure, you know, I'm going to sit here for 2 hours and, you know, engage in this craft. And 5% is what he called the magic. And he made the statement, well, it's that 5% that you can't, you know, you either have it or you don't. You know, and I was driving and I thought, I'm not sure if I agree with that sort of either you have it or you don't kind of dichotomy. Because I wanted, if he were there, I would have said, well, if you love it, you know, if you put your passion into it, the medium is going to start talking back to you. You know, it's going to come up in your life. It's going to appreciate that passion and pay you for it. That's what do you think about that?
I think that yes, you have to show up and you have to work on your skills, and then I think you have to be open to allow something else to come through.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all about me. It's, there is something else. We're informed. You know, you can talk about the news, you can talk about God, you can talk about angels, you know, something else, but something comes through. Maybe it's a deeper part of myself, but it's not my personality and ego, you know. That part gets to learn the craft.
Yeah.
And gets to enjoy it. You know, I can enjoy it. All of me can enjoy it, but there's something else comes through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Excellent. Is there something else that you want to say about in terms of the practice of your work? You say you work hard each day.
Well, sometimes. There's been, you know, my life goes through various things. At this point, I'm wanting to paint every day, but I'm not necessarily. And then there have been other times when I was working very intensely, where I was working, you know, many, you know, all day and all night. But it's varied for me. But I had to put in the hours initially, and I think I will be doing that again pretty soon. But right now, well, when I get to Sicily, I'll be painting a significant amount of time every day. That'll be great.
Yeah. Sicily, too.
Yeah, in Sicily, too. So it's like I love it when there's not all these other things that need to be taken care of. Health, for example. You know, I went through a stage of where my health wasn't, where I had to pay attention to that, and that was my teacher at that point. And I wasn't able to paint, and that was okay, you know. And then I started to be able, you know, I started to be able to again. But it was interesting because there wasn't the energy for it when I was having the health issues. My energy had to go into healing my body physically and to learning the lessons that came from it,
right.
Which fabulous. So we get given all these different things in our lives, and we get to use them.
Mm-hmm. Winnie, what does what does the work, the Gurdjieff work, if we put it in those formal terms, what does it offer to us today? And what, if anything, what is the gift there?
The work offers us a tremendous tools. I remember at the time when we were leaving the farm, when I was leaving the farm, and I realized that I had received all the tools that I needed to be able to continue working on my own. I didn't realize that I would be able to move into Carrie's group. And I was just feeling that I was going off on my own. My husband was going off. We were going off together. But I realized that, you know, I knew how to sit. I knew how to work. I knew how to, oh, goodness. I knew how to self-observe. I knew how to watch what my body was doing. I was learning to go much deeper with my thinking, with seeing what was going on in my mind and my emotions. There are all the books with talking about identification. I think the work actually... I think Gurdjieff, when he started the work, he started something that has been built on by many other people. And I think of the Tibetans. Well, they were working long ago, but they've come to the West. Mm-hmm. And Buddhism, all the different, the esoteric part of all religions is saying the same thing, but we'd moved away from the esoteric part in the West, and Gurdjieff brought it back. And as he was bringing it back, he was preparing people to be able to receive a lot of other types of esotericism.
Mm-hmm.
And to apply it at this time when we really, really need it desperately. And it's very interesting. In my classes, when I first started teaching 16 years ago, I was very careful about what I said in class, as far as the work or ideas go.
Yeah.
And in the readings that I gave, I felt like I had to be very careful and not do anything that might upset people and as far as their religious beliefs go.
Sure.
And 10 years later, that was not nearly as much the case, even though I had some people that were more fundamentalist Christians, would still say some of the work ideas couched in other terms, and they could hear them. Because they also were working.
Sure.
Which moved away to find that people that my prejudice was that, you know, the religion has a hold on them. They're just doing what they're told. But that was not the case.
Mm-hmm.
These people are working as we are, through a different format. Sure, that's not true for everybody, but it was so amazing to see that more these ideas have permeated our culture. And there's so many people, they don't call it Gurdjieff work,
mm-hmm.
but they're striving to understand who they really are, to a pretty significant degree. They want, just like I do, to go deeper and to connect. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Yeah, no, good it's answer. Yep.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a good friend of mine who introduced me into a great many of the practices and ideas of the work, Paul Rockman, would say that, the Gurdjieff teaching provides it's a quick study, as it were, in quotes, a quick study of all teachings, right? That
yeah.
you really, mm-hmm. you can connect with the esoteric part of so many other teachings through the ideas of the work, through the ideas yeah. and practices of the work, which right. is kind of what I heard coming through in what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel that I have to limit my, you know, I don't just have to read Gurdjieff and Nicol and Bennett.
Sure.
Spensky, you know, I read all kinds of people. And so that the ideas can be presented in many ways. And I feel like I need this variety
yeah.
to help go deeper. You know, somebody will say something and it'll fit in. It's like, oh, yes. And that's what I'm working on. And it'll help me to go deeper still.
Yeah, Tony Blake, who I've had on to the show a few times now, his kind of pattern in his life has been, you know, very intensive work in the traditional way, but then many years of going out into the field, you know, digesting other forms, and then, you know, bringing that back. And, you know, putting it allowing that to change his ideas of the work, you know, to chew mm-hmm. on them, to really digest them and put them into a different language, because that process is needed, because people's, you know, we change in ourselves and we change sociologically, and our vocabulary changes. We need new words to use.
And we also need to keep questioning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of Gurdjieff's main things, is question. And people that wanted to put him up on a pedestal were knocked down off of it.
Right.
So if we try to hold too tightly to something, thinking that this is how it has to be and not allowing it to evolve, it's like everything either goes up or down, and we can't hold it static. So we have to keep changing.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, I feel like we've, been able to, to share a good many things here with each other, Winnie. In terms of looking to round things off, is there something that you would, like to leave us with in terms of whether your art or in terms of being maybe even as a woman? You're the first woman I've had on the show. So
oh, wow.
Thank you for that, in terms of a woman in the Gurdjieff work or any other observations you might have that you think are important to make.
That's a big open-ended question.
Yeah, I know. I can narrow it down if you like.
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm beating around the bush, but maybe because you are the first woman I've had on the show, I'm thinking of the listener who comes to the Gurdjieff ideas through reading the material, but maybe hasn't had a group context yet, or has had a group context, but it hasn't worked for one reason or another, or they've, met people who are, dogmatic in their approach and are not, up with the changing times and so forth. As a woman in the Gurdjieff work, have you found is there anything that is repugnant there for you, or how have you included that in? Because when you read some of the material, it's not necessarily friendly to women,
Well, early on in the work when I was reading, I felt as if every time man was used, it really meant person.
Yeah.
Men was people. Gurdjieff respected women tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And all the groups I've been in have been dominated by women.
Right.
And at Two Rivers Farm, there were more women than men, and Mrs. Stavely was the head of it.
Yeah.
And again, in a group where there are many more women than men, and it's led by a woman. So I don't feel that's been a problem for me at all. But it's about we as human beings developing. But as a woman, and to me that's interesting that there are so many more women than men that I know of in the work.
Yeah.
And women seem more open to the work, to changing, to really looking at and feeling their emotions, experiencing. I couldn't give that Chilean painting to the United States Congress, although I did something along those lines later. But I had to take it down to Chile, where men had more open hearts.
Yeah.
Than they do in our culture. So, we're all in this together. We all, men have a feminine side, women have a masculine side. It's all intertwined, and it's a matter of using what we've got and developing further and further.
Yeah.
I'm surprised I haven't had any other women on it, although now that I remember looking at the list, I'm like, oh, yeah, I didn't see any names.
I've been trying. It's not for lack of trying. So double thanks for agreeing to come on to the show, definitely. And maybe I need to try harder or just in different ways. I need to open up in a different way and follow different paths. But please tell me the presentation of your painting to the Chilean Congress. Can you tell us about that? What effect did it have? Did it change the dam building project, or?
I don't know what happened after that.
Yeah.
I don't know whether the dam building project got changed, but I do know that they were tremendously touched by it. Okay. And
you planted a seed there.
Planted a seed, and the they gave me a Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
In their Congress, you know, this heavy bronze medal, you know,
yeah.
And while I was there, and they actually had a party for the painting.
Nice. Which, not for the artist, for the painting.
And I didn't get to go.
Yeah.
We were flying back. They were going to have it the night we were flying out. And I thought that was just fabulous that they were going to have this reception for the painting.
Yeah.
So that was pretty special.
And is it hanging somewhere prominent, like in the Congress itself, like in the building?
It's in the meeting room. It's in the primary meeting room. It's not in the congressional big place, which is where I wanted them to hang it.
Yeah.
But I saw the room, and it wouldn't have worked, and they knew that.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. That painting started moving around by itself, which is kind of a long story. But I took it down unframed, but with all the parts to assemble a frame. And we found a place there that could provide the glass and the backing board and assemble the frame. And I don't know. It's too much. Just too long of a story for me.
Okay.
but they came, two people came and picked it up in a truck from the frame shop, from somebody from the Congress. These two guys took it away. And then we arrived there a couple of hours later, and it was already in the President Carlo, I'm forgetting his name. Anyhow, in the President of the Congress's office. Waiting. And then after that, we were taken and shown around and take room where it was to be hung, and it was already there. And it's like, it just kept moving on its own. It's like it was, I didn't have anything more to do but watch.
Yeah. That's awesome. So it's in a room. People are using that room. It's a working room.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the energy that you were speaking of is there in the painting. So it's going to be, hopefully, in the best case, providing a point of reflection for who the decision makers who come into the room.
I hope it touches them. Mm-hmm. I also, 2 years later, took 24 paintings to Washington, D.C., and gave them out to 23 congressmen and women, senators and representatives, and one to Colin Powell.
Okay.
And again, with the intent of having the energy in the paintings support them in honoring the higher, you know, honoring people and the land, all people, and not just the rich ones, you know, not to become from a place from greed and power. So there's those paintings are out there also. And I hope they're touching people.
That's awesome. I mean, I think that art as talisman, you know, taking in the resonance, the important resonance of the energies of that the artist is bringing and are flowing through the artist. I mean, that's a very old function of art in human culture, as far as I can tell from the reading I've done and from, you know, the experience I have of making art.
Mm-hmm.
And you're very much there with that.
Mm-hmm.
When Gurdjieff talks about objective art, a lot of people can get caught up in this term. And I've, as you have, probably been part of many long conversations about what objective art is. Are we getting close to it there in terms of art that embodies some resonance that is going to potentially have an effect on people?
I wish for that. I can't claim that my art is objective, but yeah. I can wish for that.
Right.
That's what the Sacred Images workshop was. You know, we toyed with that idea and discussed it a little bit, and then came back to trying to come to a state of being as mm-hmm. we were working. That was the effort that we were making at that time. As, you know, in that workshop, it would like be an opportunity to have a group of people working together, each other, you know, all of us helping each other to make these efforts. Yeah.
Wonderful. Winnie Givaud, thank you so much for
Give it.
Thank you. I said it right at the beginning, and now I'm a Canadian, so I've got some French background too, you know. So Winnie Givaud, thank you so much for being with us here on the Idiot Players podcast. Tell us, remind us of the website and where people can go to get more information about your workshops and so forth.
My website is www.winniegivaud.com. Yeah. And Winnie, W-I-N-N-I-E, G is in George, I, V is in Victor, O, T is in Tom. All one word, Lord.
Beautiful. Faith. All right. I'm going to put that link in the show notes, you bet. And I'm also going to put some JPEGs of some of your artwork. But people can go to your website, and there you've got a beautiful gallery of your artwork that I'm sure our listeners are going to want to go and have a peek at after our conversation here.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. Good. And likewise for me, too. Take
Thank
care,
you.
Winnie.
Okay. All bye, right. Gregory.
Bye-bye now.
Among the drunks, even if there's not much wine, just the smell of it in the air will be enough to give you a
Idiot Players podcast is available for download at idiotplayers.org. Any republication in whole or in part of this podcast must include a pointer back to idiotplayers.org.